This is episode 100 of Extraordinary Women Radio. Welcome to Extraordinary Women Radio. I am your host, Cami Gilner. Women are being called to lead with voice, vitality, and vigor. Each week, join me for wisdom-filled interviews with extraordinary women living out loud and making a difference in our world. Their stories will uplift, inspire, and spark your own purpose-driven journey. Hello, my extraordinary women friends. This is episode number 100 of Extraordinary Women Radio, and what a ride it has been. I love this podcast. I have had the pleasure of and honor of interviewing so many extraordinary women from around the world, 100 of them to be exact, doing so many extraordinary deeds for our world. They are change makers, rebels, they are big dreamers, and they are the ones who make things happen. Let me give you a sampling. I have interviewed an astronaut, and she holds the record for the longest walk in space. Then there's the very first woman who ever walked around the world. Yes, literally walked all the way around the world. I've interviewed a federal judge. I've interviewed many women CEOs who have smashed through glass ceilings or grown their vision from the ground up. Several global nonprofit leaders and activists, women who are ranked among the world's top social influencers, a woman on a mission to get 1,000 women on corporate boards. Then there was a time I got to interview the lead vocalist of my favorite band that I stalked for so many months so I could make the ask. Or another, the leading NCAA women's basketball coach that I've admired for years. And perhaps some of the most rewarding have been sharing the amazing stories of my clients doing extraordinary women work. Like my client who is helping companies and women raise capital, or another who is helping take healthcare to the remote villages of Peru, another who is helping C-suite leaders find their center with mindfulness practices. I have spoken to women who grew up in Iran and India, and others who grew up on the plains of Colorado. I have done interviews with women in Jordan, in New Zealand, New York, and beyond. The diversity is immense, but the threads of commonality even more powerful. Threads of courage, of grit, the stories to persevere when things got tough, when mountains were daunting. They all followed their passions and took big risks to follow their belief, their desire to make an impact and lead with their unique style of being who they are. For that is what Extraordinary Women Radio is about. And I'm so honored to feature today's guest, Zainab Salbi, the founder of Women for Women International, on this milestone episode. I have admired Zainab for years. I supported Women for Women International for years, sponsoring women in war-torn countries. I have followed Zainab's career from the very beginning. However, I did not know all of her personal story until recently. For Zainab kept a secret hidden in the early days of starting Women for Women International, until one day she realized she had to share her story of growing up in the shadows of Saddam Hussein. She shares this story with us today and so much more. Let me introduce you to Zainab Salbi. Well, welcome to Extraordinary Women Radio, Zainab. I am so honored to host you on this 100th episode of Extraordinary Women Radio.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here with you. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you bet. And I'm going to share a story with you that you don't know yet. Just a few months ago, I sat down and I wrote down four names of who I would love to feature for this monumental episode. And your name was at the top of the list. And when I wrote that list of wish guests, I didn't have a connection to you, but I knew your story would be such a perfect match for the spirit of what Extraordinary Women Radio stands for. It's women being called to make a difference in the world. And then I was chatting with Tammy Simon of Sounds True about potential guests for this episode, and she suggested you just out of the blue. And I'm like, oh my gosh, yes. So I'm so honored to be here.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Thank you. The honor is all mine. Thank you. And I like when synergies like that happen.
Totally. Totally. And I've been a longtime supporter of Women for Women International. I have sponsored many women over the years, and I loved everything that you built with Women for Women International. It's so inspirational.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I really do. Thank you. Yeah. Any supporter of Women for Women, I'm always touched by that. It speaks into the generosity of the spirit of the person.
Yes, yes. So where are you calling from today?
New York.
You're in New York. Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. I'm sure you're always on the go. So
I am, indeed. Yeah.
And I've been reading your book, Between Two Worlds, and such a great book, by the way. And you took a big risk with vulnerability with that book. And you were at a place in your career where you'd built just an incredible organization, Women for Women International, and had helped over 400,000 women around the world. And yet you had a secret that you were keeping hidden. Can you tell us about that and tell us what was the catalyst moment that really brought your truth forward?
Well, I'll speak about the catalyst moment, which started in Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo. You know, as a humanitarian and a women's rights advocate, I was very proud of myself for helping, you know, hundreds of thousands of women through Women for Women International. And you know, I always thought that I don't have a story, that they have a story, but not me. I'm okay. I'm educated. I'm in America. I'm living a privileged life. And it's these poor women in, you know, different parts of Africa and Afghanistan. They are the ones who have a story. And, you know, it was during the second Gulf War. And I wanted to write a book about Iraqi women. Again, unprivileged, marginalized Iraqi women and their voices and their struggle and all of that. And my publisher was saying, no, we want the story about you. And I was like, I don't have a story. You don't understand. I grew up in privilege. I do not have a story. These poor women who have a story.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point I meet Nembitu, a Congolese woman who, I'm sitting in front of her in Congo. She's telling me about how she got raped. Her 9-year-old daughter got raped. Her 22-year-old daughters got raped. And how so many militias surrounded her and her daughters as they were raping them that she stopped counting. That her sons were forced to spread her legs open. And one of them was ordered to rape his mother. And when he refused, they shot him on his feet. And so she's telling me all these stories. Now, I've heard a lot of such stories, and mm-hmm. my heart always melts and pounds, and I always cry. And in this case, you know, Nembitu looked at me and she said, I never told anybody but you that story. So I look at her and I was like, well, Nembitu, do you want me to keep this a secret? Because, I mean, I'm a storyteller. What I do is I go back to America, I tell this world about your story, and so I can raise awareness and money. And the money's not going to come to you. It's going to come to many other women, including you, but not all to you, you know?
Right.
And so should I keep that one a secret? And so she looks at me and she tells me, if I can tell the whole world about what happened to me, I would. So other women would be spared from the atrocity that I faced. But I can't tell the world. You go ahead and tell the world, just not to the neighbors.
Right.
And that moment was the most humbling moment in my life. As in, I realized that this woman has more courage than I do. She has connected the story between her personal story and the larger narrative of women. That if the world knows about what happened to me, maybe they would do something and act and spare other women through going what I've gone through. And yet I, the privileged woman, was actually hiding behind her story. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
I was hiding her story, as in I'm pretending that I don't have a story, hiding the world from hiding my story from the world, and thus not helping myself and not helping other women. And in that moment, I actually, you know, I'm just saying goodbye to her. I drove for 5 hours to Rwanda and I cried throughout the whole 5 hours because I realized I was a coward. That I was asking women to break their silence and to speak up and all of that, but I was not willing to do what they were doing. And that I had a choice of either continuing my work and continuing
to actually do what I'm, preaching to women, to be strong and break their silence and all of that. But I have to start by doing it for myself, or I have to leave. If I don't have the courage to speak up, I have to leave. And it was a very important moment in my life where I ended up deciding that I need to speak up and I need to walk my walk and not just talk the talk. And in that process, I learned so much that I did not know about. I confronted my shame, my embarrassment, my family pressure and pain. I called my family and all of the other issues that comes as we break our silence. And it made me much more humble vis-a-vis other women. It made me much more respectful of the process and how painful it is. And now when I meet other women, I actually tell them my story immediately. I just say, this is who I am. So I'm now asking you to tell me your story only if you want. And I'm starting by walking my walk and not just talking it. So here's my gift and here's my story. And would you, and if you are ready to tell me your story, I would appreciate, but you don't have to. So it changed my dynamics. It taught me the power of equality and sisterhood for real. As opposed to before, I used to be self-righteous about it. Mm-hmm. And it taught me so many lessons, and mostly it led to my own healing, ultimately, and freed me from my own fear, and I realized in the process that I had become the prison guard of my own fear. And so I learned so much, but it came out of the very woman that I was actually helping. And I'm thinking, she's poor, she's illiterate, she's, in this poor reality, and she's gone through so much horrible things, and I have no story compared to her. Except when I own my own story, I realize it's not comparable to hers, and yours may not be comparable to mine, and so-and-so may not be comparable to yours, but
it's our story.
Has equal weight on our heart and our mind. And it is upon us to break that silence and not to compare it to other women's stories and then dismiss ours.
And what happened for you as you started to share your story? What happened physically in your body, right? That emotional hold that you had been holding within, what happened for you?
Well, I mean, in the process of telling it, I cried a lot.
Right.
Writing it and telling it, I cried a lot. And what really I learned, I had a lot of fear. I mean, I had fear, like my stories, I knew Saddam Hussein, that I came here in an arranged marriage, that I was raped by that very same marriage, that I, yes, lived a privileged life in Iraq, but actually at one point I had $400 in my pocket here in America. And I started from zero, that I, there was a lot of embarrassment because my image of myself as a feminist activist, strong woman, don't necessarily coincide with this vulnerable, raped, arranged marriage woman.
Right, right.
So I was even embarrassed to share that because I didn't want the stereotype to be applied to me. Oh, just because I'm from Iraq and all of that, that I must have this life. And I was so embarrassed to acknowledge to anybody that I knew Saddam Hussein, one of the worst dictators of the last century.
Right, and you knew him in a very frequent basis. You spent a lot of time in the shadows of Saddam Hussein.
Well, my father was his private pilot, and my family were his social friends. We had, we're not political, and so we had no political threats to him, and we were entertainers, we're not in the program. My mom was a teacher, my father was a pilot, but we played the role of social, the friends that he hang out with and danced to Western music too, and taught him how to eat with a fork and spoon and things like that. It's a social entertaining, basically, no political substance. But that horrified me because I really was worried and believed that if I tell anybody I knew Saddam Hussein, that my actual faith and my identity would disappear and he would take over. His identity would so be overcoming mine, overwhelming mine. Right. And so there's a lot of the thing that I carried was heavy. And what I realized when I broke my silence is a couple of things. One is that you actually do take a leap of faith when breaking your silence. It is like jumping off the cliff, mm-hmm. not knowing whether you're going to land or not. And in between the landing and the jumping, there's the abyss, you know, where you go through your abyss, basically. And so it's a very scary experience. Two, I learned it, you always land one way or the other. You fall on water, you land on your feet, you land because you find your wings and fly, you land. You'll be okay, one way or the other, you know? Third, I realized I actually, in the process of my fear, at one point, I became the prison guard to my fear, and that I needed to like let go of that prison guard in my fear, and that liberating myself from inside. It's a very inside, you know, my last book is called Freedom is an Inside Job. And that was the first step towards my freedom, is to let go of the prison guard I had on my own fear. I was afraid to utter the words of Saddam Hussein in my own backyard here in America. This is how much my fear was. Right. And so by breaking its silence, by basically stripping myself naked in front of the whole world, by telling them my story, I took control over my story. I basically said, you cannot hurt me anymore, because I am initiating the vulnerability and telling the truth and the full truth and nothing but the full truth. So you cannot blackmail me, you, by that fear. And that you is the world, and that you is me.
Right.
Do you see what I mean? So
totally.
And then the last but not least is that I, you know, so many women, I mean, a lot of that fear was inside, but when I broke the silence and spoke up, so many women here in America and back home in Iraq would walk up to me and tell me, thank you for telling your story. And then they would pursue by telling me their story. And what I mean, and what the ones in America, I really had no idea what, I mean, like it was their stories from a different culture. But I realized, oh my God, I have eventually become like Ninbitu. When one woman breaks her silence, she becomes like the candle that lights other women's darkness, you know, it sort of, and helps the other woman get out of the darkness of her own cave. And then B2 did that for me. And then in my owning my own story, I became the candle for this other woman. And, you know, this other woman becomes the candle in the other woman. Eventually, over 10 years, I came to realize freedom is an inside job. You know, it started with telling my story, and it ended up teaching me that I am the cake of my own happiness, and that the taste of freedom is indeed so delicious that it is worth the hard journey one has to go through in order to free ourselves from all the chains of the past.
It's so important. It's so important that we find our stories and we let those stories come to the forefront. And when we do that, it's so powerful. And what you're saying, it's powerful for everyone in the room. So it's, and that's what shifts things, and that's what moves things. So it's so beautiful. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in Iraq as you? And I highly encourage our listeners to go listen to, or go read your book, Between Two Worlds, because I think I'm just so entrenched into those stories. But just give a little synopsis. I mean, I know there was a lot of fear that you faced at that point, even.
Oh, I grew up with fear. I mean, as I was writing my book, I would say, how do I express fear for people? Because for me, fear is a very tangible thing. You smell it. Fear is like poison gas that you breathe it every day and you die slowly from it, you know, until you die. Mm-hmm. I grew up with my mom telling me I could see the prison bar in front of me. I just cannot prove to anybody that they exist, but I see them and I mm-hmm. hold them and I touch them. And so my life was a juxtaposition, a contradiction between a very good upper middle class family. My father was a pilot. We traveled all over the world. I went to a nice school. I spoke English from when I was 4 years old, you know, in an Arabic speaking society. It's sort of, I went to piano lessons, all of that. And there's the other side, which is Saddam was in our family's life. And so he would show up in the middle of the night. Actually, he showed up anytime he wanted. Everyone would have to like dress up immediately and smile and, you know, at our best behavior. Our, you know, phones were bugged. Our rooms were bugged. Our, you know, we fear talking to our own parents. My parents would speak, I mean, like if the 70s of my life were like all fun and happiness and joy, in the 80s when he took over, my parents would, you know, sit in the middle of the garden on plastic chairs with the radio blasted really high, loud, and they would whisper to each other's ears, even though they are in the middle of the garden and the high radio, basically. That's how they communicated. We, you know, when we saw him every single weekend, almost in our life, in my life, and as, you know, when I was a teenager, basically, not when I was a child. And the rules is to smile when he smiled and cry when he cried, you know, and, you know, every time he says, is this nice? Yes, very nice, uncle. Is this sad? Yes, very sad, uncle. We just would to mimic his emotions as a way to survive. And my mom would tell me, it's like, do not look him in the eyes. Do not look him in the eyes. He knows how to read eyes. And so it was between this in my, you know, like weekend and evening, and then in school I refused to. And my parents, you know, what I you learn in wars or in conflict areas or in fear is that people don't resist in this, you know, Superman movies that we have, you know, or, you know, heroic movies. People resist in small ways. People resist in small acts, you know, of resistance where they can keep their soul and their integrity and their dignity intact. And so my parents resisted in these small ways. They resisted by, you know, helping me not go to the palace school where all the other girls would be, you know, daughters of officials. And I went to not only a regular school, I went to a school on the margin between a poor neighborhood and a middle-class neighborhood. And because it was an experimental school and had a different curriculum, and I really wanted to go there. But in daytime, I would hear classmates talking about how their fathers got killed or how there was an execution, a public execution in that neighborhood, in the street, and anybody who had a gun just shot at the man who was pinned to the wall. And so I would go to, you know, in the daytime, I'm like hearing these horror stories of what people were facing. And at night, I'm going to Saddam and he would, she's talking about eating caviar and drinking champagne. And it, that, and in the middle, which is my family, somewhere in the middle of that is living in fear. I grew up with my mom committing suicide and over and over. I mean, trying to commit suicide over and over and over again. So you have these, all these juxtapositions. They're none of them like the movies where one character is purely evil and one character is purely in it. Everyone was struggling, and including him. I mean, he, for me, the devil is a fallen angel. There were moments I know him as uncle, laughing and dancing, and there are moments which were very scary because he killed his own best friends. So all of that was my reality.
Right. You know, what's really interesting for me is within the past few weeks, I interviewed one of my clients, Arzu Zarafshan, and she's an extraordinary woman who really helps women raise capital. You know, Arzu grew up in Iran during the Iran-Iraq war, and she shared her personal story of growing up in a war-torn country as a child. So just within the last few weeks, I've had this conversation. And as I was reading one of some of your writing this week, you wrote as a young, you wrote, as a young girl, I never thought about the children in Iran who were facing some of the same impacts of the war. And, you know, in writing that statement, it was very clear there was another time where you started to connect this notion that there were children on the other side of that war, just like you. So talk a little bit about that. I mean, this, where did you find that notion of connecting to people on the other side of conflict? And how does that apply just in life in general? I mean, it's like so often we can be in conflict of some sort, and there is always that other side of it. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, at the very young, I mean, I was 10 years or 11 years old when the Iran-Iraq war started. And at a very young age, I realized, okay, the news, you know, the newspaper and the news on TV were just showing the frontline discussion. You know, they were showing the machines, the guns, and the tanks, and the army man, and all of these things, right? But as a kid living in war, it was really women who were running the show in my life, you know. Mm-hmm. Everyone was a woman in the street, basically. The teachers, the doctors, my mother, you know, the store owner, everyone, the factory workers, everyone. And what I realized is, oh my God. At a very young age, by the way, because you see it, it's clear in your face kind of thing, you know. So it's like, oh, so the world sees war as men see war, but they do not see war as women see war.
Oh,
and if men are leading the frontline discussion, which is the war, the fighting, women are leading the backline discussion, which is keeping life going. Just keeping life going, running the factories, running the hospitals, running the schools, keeping my mom, keeping us going, keeping the smiles going, all of that. And until today, we do the same thing, by the way. We don't realize, like, life in war continues. It does not stop. You still fall in love and you still go to a birthday party and you still, like, laugh and you still get divorced and you still, all of these things, basically, they're still going in the midst of war, and it's women who are running the show in the backline discussion.
Yes.
And so it's impacted me in many ways. It's impacted my whole career. I mean, that's how I started Women for Women International, which helps women survivors of wars. And my biggest argument, besides helping individual women survivors of wars, is basically saying we have got to understand war and peace from women's perspective. And we've got to define war and peace not only from weapons and stopping the fighting, but actually stopping the fighting and building peace. And women define building peace in a different way. Not only stop fighting, they define it in building institutions and infrastructure and keep, you know, get us, you know, we need to get the schools better and the bicycles and the jobs and all. They define it in a very, very different perspective than men do. And so that impacted me a lot. And it became beyond, you know, like, that's how I see a war right now. And I, you know, for 20 years, I worked in war zones. That's the mission of Women for Women International. And that becomes the essence of it. It's like, how do you, you know, because you understand a story that is not told otherwise, you know. And
right.
So whether it is in Bosnia, whether in Afghanistan, whether in Iran, or whether any country, I've never been to Iran, but meeting Iranians here, but any country that I worked in, Congo, Rwanda, Southern Sudan, Nigeria, my own home country, Iraq, you actually have an immediate connection with women there because you know a story that they are, you live through it, and then they, you know, that they're living through it. So it's an instant connection of, we are the invisible talent, we're the invisible warriors, basically, that are yet to be visible, but who cares, because we need to keep it going.
Right. And that's amazing. That's fascinating to me. And I've never thought of it in that, you know, that's the other side of it. We see the front side of it, but we don't see the foundational side of it, where the women are keeping things going.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And still, I mean, I tell to any male politicians, I say, if you really want to understand a story of a country or a nation or a community, please just don't meet with women for like a couple of hours. Go and spend the 3 days visit with women. You will understand a story you do not realize otherwise. You know, women are the bellwether for the direction of society, in my opinion. Bad things start with women and good things start with women. And rather than seeing women as a marginal issue, let's invite a couple of women to join the conversation, we've actually, if we see them as a central issue, we change our whole lens and perspective of not only that society or that culture or that community, but how do we go about building sustainable peace? That women have a different narrative that is very important to add into the discussion.
Yes, yes. So your mother was a great protector. Tell us a little bit about her. I know she, you know, eventually was the one that sent you to America, and for a good reason, which you didn't understand at the time. But tell us a little bit about your mother and how you ended up coming to America.
Well, my mom was a feminist. I mean, she, as a teenager, she made me read all these books about feminism and about social justice, to be honest. I mean, listen, this is a woman in Iraq, studied in Iraq, lived all her life in Iraq. I mean, she came to the States and Europe for vacation, you know, but that is a pure Iraqi woman who made me at the age of 12 and 13, not only read all the classic novels, European novels, but made me more than that, read Roots, about what happened to African Americans here in this country. Mm-hmm. And she made me read, I mean, all kinds of feminist, you know, books. And they were all in Arabic that I read them. And she would, like, you know, with intention, she would go to the bookstore and buy me these books. And it's like, you've got to read these books, you know. Mm. And so by the age of 15, and she would tell me about the oppression of women from her own mother to herself, to like her grandmother, mother, herself. And each one, the story seems that each woman pushes her daughter to a better future. And each woman pushes her daughter to the other. I mean, and if I look at my own female lineage, woman lineage, I would say I'm a product of each one pushing the other for a better. And I probably got it the best so far. and I hope that my nieces get it even better, basically.
Yes,
you know, that's how it works, basically, you know. But so she, as a teenager, my mom would tell me, you always have to be strong. You've got to be independent. Never depend on any man financially. And she would tell me, never let anybody touch you or talk to you in the wrong way. And over time, you know, she was very adamant. Like, I mean, this is, she would shake me in these things, not like, oh, honey, do that. Like, dude, like, this is like a, with passion, she's telling me these things. Mm-hmm. Choose the man you want to do, da-da, all of these things. And then all of a sudden, at the age of, you know, 1920, she would tell me, it's like, well, honey, you've got this marriage proposal from this guy in America, and then please accept him. And, you know, arranged marriage, you know, the first notion of arranged marriage, you think is being forced. It's really not being forced. It means it's arranged, you know, as in, I mean, I call actually the internet dating site arranged, you know, dating, you know, basically,
yes.
You know, I mean, but basically that's what it is. You know, of a man who wants to look for a bride, you look at the bride, you connect them, and then ultimately it's their decision, but, you know,
it was pushed, you know, it was guided.
It was guided, right? Yes. And then you really don't, you know, anyway, so more or less than that. In my case, I didn't know him. He was much older than me. I said no, but my mom would cry vehemently. I mean, I've got a lot of marriage proposals from these arranged marriages kind of thing. And I would always say no, you know, and it's not a big deal. And this one, my mom would cry and would tell me, you've got to accept the marriage. Please just go to America. Just go. Do whatever you want to do after that. But right now, just go. And also, you know, the truth is I just wanted, I said yes, not because I knew him, not because I liked him, not because of anything. I said yes, simply because I wanted my mom to stop crying.
Right.
And when I entered America and we entered to Chicago and I saw him waiting for me at the airport, and I tell you, I was just like, you know, I got anxiety the minute I laid eyes on him. It was like, ugh, you know. And not because he was bad looking or anything, like, it's just like, whatever, just, I just got anxiety. And, you know, the marriage happens very fast. My parents go back to Iraq within, you know, 2 weeks, basically within a month of my arrival to America. Iraq invades Kuwait. My family are back at home. I'm a new bride, and I end up, few things happens to me. One is the night of our wedding till I left him 3 months later, the man was violent, mm-hmm. verbally and sexually. Mm-hmm. And my family were in Iraq, so I couldn't call them and tell them, I need to get out of here, help me.
Right.
And I basically had no money. I mean, I was vulnerable. I was basically left to his own protection. And a long story short, I end up leaving with $400 in my pocket, 2 suitcases of designer clothes, but $400 in my pocket,
right.
And basically never looking back and vowing to myself that I am going to do something out of my life. And one day I shall go home and I will help there. But right now I'm going to build my life here. And that was my beginning in America. And that was the day I left him was September 1990, end of September 1990. And here I am, you know.
Here you are. And the seeds were planted from that space. Now, and before I move on to that next, these seeds, there was reason your mother wanted you to leave Iraq.
There was. Thank you for bringing up. I always talk only about the first part, but never finish the second part. And partially because, you know, I didn't end up seeing my family for many, many years later. And in my mom's case, for less than 9 years, about 8 years. And I was angry at her. I felt betrayed by her.
Right.
I felt the woman I loved the most in my life betrayed me. And so it broke my heart. And then she came to America. She was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, and we knew she was dying. And literally the year before her death, we started talking. And now she lost her voice. And so there's an irony of that. She would only communicate with me in writing, and I couldn't hug her. I mean, that's how I'm mad at her. I mean, I'm her only daughter. So I moved from loving her to not wanting to hug her. And in the process of her death, I asked her, like, why did you do that to me? And that's when she started writing me. And I had already founded Women for Women International. And I would go home every day and from work, and I would find her writing me chapters of her book, in which she would narrate what happened. And ultimately, the story is she was so worried that Saddam was taking a like to me, and she was so worried that she could not protect me. And she told me about what he had done to so many women around him. And no one could protect themselves from it. And so there were many incidents that she would talk about. Frankly, you know, it took me a lifetime of trauma in my own thing to deal with these incidents. But I didn't know. I mean, like the adult, the child in me did not understand the predator in him. The teenage in me did not understand the predator in him. The woman in me today understands the predator in him, you know? And if I had a teenage daughter and in the context where I was, I don't know what would I have done. But now I'm 49 years old and I understand that. I understand that fierceness of protecting your child.
Yes.
I didn't understand it when I was 20 years old, you know? And I for her, it was the only option to get me out of his sight, which is to get out of the country. And she used to say, I don't care what you do once you arrive here, just accept the marriage.
Right.
You know, she died, you know, so she died with, you know, in the process of her death, she gave me her best gift.
Totally.
And that is my story.
Right.
In the process of my mother's death, she gave me the truth, and that is her story as well. And that's when healing started. Like, that's what utter healing started. So she died, and it's been more than nearly 20 years now. But, you know, there was healing with her death and peace, you know, at that. And I not only forgive her, I also understand her at the moment.
Exactly. And I think, like you said, the best gift she could have given you was that.
And that's also when I mentioned earlier, people resist in small ways. They do not resist in big ways. You resist, you know, when fear is around you. I mean, we judge people in other countries who are living under dictatorships or whatever, but when it's in your face every day, unless if you are the hero that's willing to lose not only your life, but everything in your life and everyone and every loved ones for their cause. And these people exist. It's just there are not many of them in humanity, by the way, you know. Most people do resist. It's not that they're, you know, culpable to the dictatorship and the authoritarian and the oppression. It's that they resist in their ways as they navigate the survival of their own families. And I moved from being very angry at my family for being in that relationship to compassionately loving and grateful for both my parents did to help us stay intact and to be safe ultimately, but also for their own resistance to keep an aspect of who we are intact and not be all succumbed by his fear.
Right, right. So you were only 23 when the idea of Women for Women International, the seeds got planted, right? And you stepped into it. So where did the courage come from that had you saying, yes, I am going to do this?
So when I come to America, I grew up coming to America on vacation,
right.
Mm-hmm. But never living in here. And when I came here, I moved to D.C. I, you know, fell in love with a Palestinian-American man. We got married, and I was like opening my eye to this whole idea. And I went back to college in here because I left my college in Iraq unfinished. And so I was opening my eye to this whole idea of, wow, you know, there is a freedom of expression and there's like people, are, you know, they can say what their mind, whatever is in their mind, which is amazing because, you know, I grew up fearing my own walls in my own bedroom, you know?
Right, right.
And so I learned. It was, I was taking a class about the Holocaust, and it was my first time to take such learn about the Holocaust, you know, at George Mason University. And in that same month, there was news coverage all over the media, and in particular Newsweek and Time Magazine, coverage of like front page, the image of Bosnians in concentration camps and rape camps. And as I was reading about the Holocaust and people were saying never again, I actually was seeing similar images, different, but similar, you know, in terms of concentration camps happening today. And it was a very basic, I would say, innocent, childlike calculation. That was wrong. And we said, never again. So this is happening. So we must do something. Like it was like 1 + 1 = 2. We have to do something.
Right.
And at the beginning, I demonstrated. You know, as we all go to demonstrations these days, you know,
right.
I went and demonstrated and all of that. And, you know, I shouted here and I shouted and I would go and the bullhorn and no peace, no justice and all of these things. And, you know, participating in the silent demonstrations and the first were all kinds of demonstrations. And honestly, about 3-4 demonstrations later, I was like, this is not going to work. What we feel good about ourselves for these hours that we're in the demonstrations, but we're not helping the people. We need to help the people. So there were no websites at that time. I picked up the Yellow Pages and I started calling women's organizations and saying, what are you doing to help women in Bosnia? Long story short, one of them said, all of them were saying not, come call us after 6 months. But one of them said, listen, we're getting the same call from the Unitarian Church. Why don't you call them? And I call the Unitarian Church. I tell them this is what I want to do. They meet me. At that time, I tell them this is what I want. I come up with an idea of like, because I didn't have money. I didn't have anything.
Right,
I have work
right.
experience. You know, I just wanted to help and I didn't want to just demonstrate. And frankly, I stopped demonstrating afterwards because for me, it's about tangible actions and demonstrations work, making a statement. But after the statements, we need to act basically.
Right.
And so, you know, so now I went and they said, okay, we'll support you for a year. And after that year, you're on your own. And sure enough, that's the foundation of Women for Women International. It started with that story. And I started asking every woman to support one woman at a time by sending her $30 a month. At that time, it was $20 a month. It's over time increased. And sending her a picture and a letter of yourself. And because I wanted to always create equality between women, because, you know, it's easy that we think that, oh, we are saving them. She's the victim. I'm the savior. But for me, we are just simply more privileged than those who are in war zones and who may look different.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fluke. It's a luck that you are in this country and
Absolutely.
She is in Afghanistan, you know,
exactly.
It's just, and we cannot take that luck for granted. And so you may feel better about yourself for helping her and you should, but also you're not superior to her. So I wanted to share the stories and in our stories is our equalities. Because we're all humans, ultimately. And so in my aspect is share with her your resources, $30 a month, which is affordable to most people.
Okay.
But share
yes.
with her something else and share with her that story. Because with that, you show her that you're equal to her, like you are really her sister. And she will share that with you as well. And sure enough, it started with me distributing aid to 33 women in Bosnia and Croatia, actually, at that time in 1993, September 1993. Women for Women just celebrated its 25 years anniversary, where we helped more than 500,000 women in conflict
wow.
areas, connecting them with more than 500,000 women here in America and distributing nearly 120 million dollars to them.
Wow.
And so it all sprang from basically I was not technically a refugee, but technically, yeah, I mean, not legally a refugee, but I, you know, technically a refugee, you know, in here, in this country from Iraq, escapee from an arranged marriage with $400. And that led to helping 500,000 women, if not 1 million women, connecting 1 million women with each other. And so it makes me believe that it is possible to make a difference in this world. And it is possible to make change. And I never went about it thinking it's going to be big. I just didn't care if it's going to be big or small, but I tried. And I still today try in different ways. And I try now, not only by my work, I try by my action. I try by buying ethical clothes rather than, you know, junk clothes that is hurting the environment. I try by buying ethical, you know, sustainable food rather than buy food that is hurting the environment. I try by donating, yes, but doing other actions that sometimes entail sacrifice in my personal life. So it started by only giving out. And now where I am is I need to be in alignment in my personal life and behavior. And there were times in which I wasn't aligned. I would give to women, poor women in conflict areas, but I would buy a shirt that may have oppressed other women in some dungeons, in some factory, in some country, you know, and I needed to be aligning these values together between that and between, you know, between my buying and my giving. And that's where I am today. But it makes me believe it is possible to make a difference in this world.
Absolutely. What do we need to know about the status of women in our world today? When you know, a lot of listeners here tuning in, what do we need to know about the status of women in our world?
Well, if this is a mountain, we are halfway up the mountain. We are not there on top of the mountain yet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are things to celebrate, but don't be satisfied. You know, like, I mean, when I'm saying celebrate, yes. Honor our elders who led us to this moment, as I was talking about my grandmother, you know, but honor all the women who have led us to this moment, basically. But we are not to tap on our shoulders and say how great we are. We've done it. We have not done it yet.
We have
and there's a lot of work to be done, you know,
yeah.
And it entails all women from all different socioeconomic backgrounds and throughout the world. So there's a lot of work to be done. I do think it's also, you know, so a lot of work to be done in the basics, which is we need equal pay, equal representation in decision making, in political parties, all of that. But there's also the ones that are not visible, as in we need to pay attention to domestic workers, for example, and are we treating them equally and, you know, protecting their labor rights when their employers are mostly women, us, you know? Are we walking our own walk, not only in asking for equal pay in my corporate work, but am I paying my house cleaner or my nanny or the caregiver for my parents? Am I paying her and treating her and protecting her labor law, you know,
right.
practices, basically, you know? So do you see what I mean? So we need to shift, in my opinion, where we're not only the victims are asking, but are we the oppressors of other women?
Right.
You know?
Owning our responsibility.
Exactly. And the invisible woman in our own lives and waitresses and all kinds of invisible women. So it's not only the poor other women in Africa, but is the invisible woman in here in this country. So I feel there's a lot to be done. And it's not only about men changing, which men need to change. And it's not only about patriarchy, a system outside of us, needs to change, which it does need to change. But it's also about us women who are a product of patriarchy, who are within the system of patriarchy. We also must reflect on ourselves and see where we have lost track of ourselves and where we are replicating the very thing we are fighting against, because we all have that story. I do, you know?
Right.
And
right.
So we have to really be more thorough. And in my opinion, this is our moment, not only to speak up about our injustices, but to lead differently. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I am worried, you know, I am not worried. I'm saying, but I'm pointing at, saying we are risking the fact that we are leading like men, or like patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. We need to lead like women.
You know, we need to show and demonstrate how female and feminine leadership is different. And I don't see it yet. We have not demonstrated yet. But it is incumbent upon all of us to do it. For if we don't do it, we will lose. We will lose. We become just talking about our victimhood, but not demonstrating what newness new leadership, new vision is, and we need to show the path forward for all women and men alike.
Oh, that could open up a whole nother, I would love to go into that much deeper because it's such a passionate topic for me. I love that topic, but I know we can't do that today. We're running out of time. The final question that I always close this interview with is, what three pearls of wisdom would you like to leave with our audience today?
Oh, yeah, yeah, there's a lot. Where do I start? I would say one is only when we tell the truth can healing start happening. Mm. Only when we tell the truth can we start the process of healing. Second, we build a bridge, it will be destroyed. Build a bridge, it will be destroyed again. Build a bridge until so many people are part of building that bridge. It cannot be destroyed.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And that means we need to reach out to others and the others, whoever the others are from the other side. And we need to be in dialogue and conversations so we can show the path forward. We need to lead in showing the path forward, in my opinion,
yes,
in any division that is happening in our lives or in our country or in the world. The third thing is, and this I came to it in the long, hard way, we can forgive even when not asked for forgiveness. We can and we need to forgive even when not asked for forgiveness. And what I mean by that is, in my global experience, the group who has been most victimized, you know, whether it is Blacks in South Africa or Tutsi in Rwanda, are the ones who show the path for truth and reconciliation. Reconciliation particularly, and because the aggressors do not have the legitimacy to show that path. And so we are now at a moment for all women to start reflecting and discussing what is the path for truth and reconciliation in the war between the sexes at the moment, and in a divisive moment for all of us. And so start by telling your story, but don't think it is done. Second, start engaging in dialogue. And third, how do we envision a story for all of us, collectively, women and men included?
Thank you so much, Zainab. I so appreciate your time today and sharing of your story and everything that you are doing in our world. It's so inspirational, and I'm honored to have been able to have you join us today.
Oh, what a pleasure. I really appreciate the conversation, and I hope we can continue.
I hope so, too. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you.
You have a good day.
Thanks.
I hope you liked this episode of Extraordinary Women Radio. If you did, please share this podcast with your own special tribe of women and help spread the love, the dreams, and the inspiration. Are you ready to raise up your voice, your visibility, and your business? I invite you to visit me at CammieGelner.com to find out how you can make heartfelt connections to mindful strategies to ignite an abundant flow of cash and clients into your business. I'd love to hear from you on any of my social media channels. I'm on both Facebook and Twitter. Till next time, my friend, listen to your heart, follow your dreams, and be you.